Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here today. We talk physical therapy. We'll start with taking a look at hip pain with our two guests. Our physical therapist back once again with me in the studio, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to see your smiling face.
It's great to be here, Larry.
And with us by Google Meet.
Yes.
We can see her, but she's not here. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, welcome back.
Awesome to be here, Larry and Jill and everyone.
So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Let us know where your hips are hurting, maybe, or burning, which movements make them sore. Take your general physical therapy questions as well. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Lori, how often do we see patients, or do you see patients, coming in with hip pain?
Oh, very, very often. I work in a spine clinic, and so we see spine, we see hip. As Jill and I have talked about in the past, it's kind of a no man's land. So when people come in with hip pain, it takes a fair amount of investigation to sort out if the primary source of that pain is the hip joint itself, if it's some of the soft tissue around the hip joint, or if it's being referred from the low back. And the assumption is it's one of those things, but chances are it's some combination of all three of those things. and so the process of the diagnostic process is sort of figuring out which of those is at the top of the list and which one you address first. The result of that is that it takes some time to get better, because we're usually dealing with a number of different issues, both at the hip, the primary hip, sometimes the opposite hip because of compensation, sometimes the back because of compensation, sometimes the hip hurts because they're compensating for the back. So it's really a bit of a quagmire. And so it takes some time to sort these issues out. And sometimes it's a process of trial and error of addressing the intervention at one specific area and seeing how it plays out.
Are there certain, jobs or lifestyles that are more likely to wind up experiencing hip pain?
I don't know that there's any specific job or activity that will put somebody at risk for hip pain. I think a few things that come to mind for me are, as with any joint, making sure that you have appropriate strength and mobility around the joint. And I guess the job that would potentially be of concern is somebody who does the same motion over and over and over again for 20 or 30 years, especially if it's an asymmetrical motion. I do remember many, many years ago, one of the physicians I worked with saw significant arthritis in one hip in an individual and zero arthritis in the other one. And the person worked on a train and always got up and down out of the train with the same leg.
Oh.
And so if you do something hugely asymmetrical, I think that would probably put you at risk.
Well, and Jerry, you brought some hip clinical practice guidelines that
yes.
are recently published.
Yes.
What do they say?
So, well, the wonderful Sports Physical Therapy and Orthopedic Academies within the American Physical Therapy Association periodically update these things called clinical practice guidelines. And experts in the field scour the literature and compile all the literature related to this topic, and based on that, come up with recommendations that clinicians can use. And based on the type of research they find, whether it's really robust research, such as randomized controlled trials or systematic reviews or meta-analyses, down to, let's just say, a case report. They look at the quality of the research and the quantity of the research, and they take all that information and they compile it and they make recommendations. And this clinical practice guideline is actually an update from a recommendation they created 10 years ago. So this recommendation existed, and they took the latest 10 years of research and compiled it. Exactly, and updated it. And of course, when I saw it, I got really excited because, as Lori alluded to, treating the hip, diagnosing the hip can be really, really challenging. And so I thought, oh, thank goodness, I'm going to get an answer. And you know what? We didn't get a really good answer. What it validated for me was that exactly what Lori said is there's a lot of trial and error to this. So many of the assessments that they had were graded a letter C, which means it's probably worth trying, but there's not this hard, robust evidence that it's going to give you that definite diagnosis. One of the things that came out with a pretty high outcome was that using an outcome tool that you have your patient fill out at the beginning regarding their hip pain, what bothers them, and then filling that tool out at the end again, at the end of care, is actually a really good strategy. But for the rest of it, in my mind, Lori, there wasn't anything that was a game changer for me other than, wow, everybody else struggles with this as much as I do.
Right. And I think, you know, in terms of that outcome measure, they also want to look at some of the psychosocial factors that affect this. And that is not just pain or whatever, but also thinking about depression, anxiety, self-efficacy, and what we call kinesiophobia, which is a fear of movement. So those are things we also need to look at. In terms of interventions, what they have found is that the best level evidence suggests what we call a multimodal approach. And that is, there's not one single thing that is going to be a home run. It's going to be a combination of a number of things, some mobility, some strengthening, a lot of education on how do you move? How do you spend your day? Are you sitting? And, you know, sometimes patients will walk in and you'll look at them and you'll say, you have no gluteal muscles whatsoever, suggesting that they're not using the right muscles to create and utilize during movements. So we have to look at a number of different interventions, and then patients have to do them.
Right. Right. Compliance is very important.
Oh, yeah. Oh my goodness. So my 30 years or so of swinging a golf club has resulted for the first time in some issues.
Larry has an owie, Lori.
Ooh, okay.
First time ever. He injured his right side, mid to low back, literally going from sit to stand, getting out of a golf cart. And he never uses a golf cart. He always walks. But he just happened to sit for a moment while someone else was teeing off. But most importantly, Lori, ask the million-dollar question. This happened at hole 5. Ask the most important question.
Oh, did you continue playing?
Of course he did.
Of course I did.
And how did you feel at the end?
Well, when I sat down and stood up, I felt terrible, but I could get through otherwise. And I was walking the whole way anyway. As long as I didn't sit down, I was okay.
So we've worked through a few things today, this morning in the studio, but we've talked about just easy, gentle range of motion. And, you know, I asked Larry to do a movement and he said it hurt. And I said, well, let's do a few more and see what happens. And okay, it's getting a little better. It's loosening up a little bit. It's not so bad. And so we've developed some mobility strategies, exactly what you said, Lori, about things that he can be doing in the short term. And then we did a lot of education about when you make transitional movements, you should do this. And Lori's going to give you some advice from another time zone.
Okay. No, but what I wanted to say, you said something really important, Jill.
Oh, good.
And that is you had him do the movement once and it hurt, but you didn't tell him to stop. you had them repeat it because you want to see what the response is. Does it continue to increase as you repeat it? And then that's a hard stop. But there are some things that as you repeat it, it starts to feel better. And that's your opening for your rehab program. Well played.
That's exactly right. I said, well, do 3 or 4, Larry, and let me know if it's getting better, getting worse, or staying the same. And he said, well, I think it's getting a little better. But what I pointed out to him was every repetition he did, he gained more range of motion. So that's also a sign it's better. So
right. And then the next phase of that, or the next thought is, you want to see how that plays out over time. Mm-hmm. So you want to repeat that activity a little bit later today and see if you get the same response, to see if what you did stirred the pot and now it hurts to do it, or if it gets a little better. So this is the process that we go through. This is normal. So then we would educate our patient to say, look, I want you to do the same thing a couple more times today and let me know if it progressively gets better or if we stirred things up and it starts to get worse now.
Yep, and control all the other variables. So we're not going to throw a bunch of other things at him. He's already doing a couple strategies, and we'll let him continue to do that. Of course, you know the question he asked, Lori, don't you?
Can I play golf?
There you go.
I'm hoping on the weekend.
Oh, we know you so well, Larry.
His goal is Friday. He needs to golf by Friday. And I said, well, that's possible. He's moving around. We'll see how things go. But we don't really have enough information right now. We don't know that trajectory because we only have basically one point of data. So as Larry does these, if he starts accelerating in this huge upward spiral that, oh, yeah, the mobility is so much better. Those stretches are better. I can go farther. I can move better. Going from sit to stand doesn't hurt anymore. All those things, that'll kind of help us predict if he'll be able to golf on Friday.
Well, so much about so much for me.
So much for Larry.
Let's go to Gary in the town of Ween. Gary, hi.
Thank you, Larry, for the great show and your guest. At the end of October 2021, I was cutting firewood and accidentally cut into 4 toes on my left foot.
Ooh.
I cut into the bone and had to have surgery, and the surgeon said I'd severed tendons, and she would do the best she could, but when I came out of surgery, I might not have 10 toes. Well, all the toes were saved, and I'm getting better, and I have stretches. I went to different physical therapists, and they gave me different stretches, but after a while, like maybe 3 to 4 hours of use, it starts in my ankle and then the outside of my left leg and then up into my left hip. And I was wondering, I'm really active and I do stretches all the time. Is there anything else I should incorporate?
So the foot injury sounds like it's leading to some hip pain.
Absolutely. It's my best guess is, and do you, Gary, do you walk with a limp? So you said after 3 or 4 hours, do you have a normal gait or is there a limp that has manifested with all of this major trauma you experienced?
With about 3 to 4 hours, then I have discomfort in that left hip and I walk with a limp. Yes.
Okay. So it sounds to me like so far all the focus has been on your foot. I think you need, as Lori would say, a stem to stern evaluation and look at all the muscles proximal to that. So looking at your hip strength, looking at your ankle strength, you mentioned the lateral side of your ankle. I wonder if he's got some peroneal weakness. And look at strengthening those things and make sure that you have adequate strength above and below and make sure that those joints have adequate mobility. Lori, is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, how long has it been since you saw a physical therapist?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Probably a year.
Yeah. It's time.
I went to see one and then they said, well, this is as far as we can take you and just keep doing them at home. And I always remember what the doctor says, those three terrible words, as you age.
as you age. All right. So
things do change. And I'm sure because of the magnitude of this trauma that you had, your physical therapist at that point, we're really focused on getting foot function back. And then you achieve that foot function. And so then, you know, your third party payer said, well, you have achieved the goal of good function in your foot, but nobody looked farther up the kinetic chain. And now over time, it's starting to manifest. So I think you need to go back to physical therapy, maybe, you know, with this complaint of hip or leg or someplace else in that chain pain, and get a good evaluation to help increase the time that you can be active without a limp.
Right. I mean, who would have thought that you'd be able to do 3 to 4 hours worth of work on this foot? I'm sure the physical therapist you saw a year ago did not expect you to have this high level of activity. And now as a consequence of that, we're identifying other pathologies. So yeah, I'd go back and see somebody, Gary, and keep going.
Good luck, Gary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Talking physical therapy with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody and Trina LaSousa, who's our engineer, and Clara Neipert, who is our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for tuning in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with our guest, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Let's take some more calls. Sharon in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Did you ask for Sharon?
I did.
Oh, thank you. I didn't hear you. I had a hip replacement about a year and a half ago, and then 3 months before that, I had the other hip replaced. They both went great. And then, because they were so great, after the second hip, I got a little over-ambitious and stretched a little too much, and I could feel immediately a groin pull. And so I stopped doing what I was doing. I backed off. And then I also started taking care of my brand-new grandson, which after 6 weeks after the hip replacement. So that added to it. But now it's been a year and a half. I did mention to my surgeon 3 months after the surgery that I was having this groin pain, and they kind of said, oh, yeah, you know, you feel good, you always do too much. And they kind of blew it off. And now it's better, but I still have pain when I go up steps especially and trying to lift that leg. I did go through PT. I had about, 6 or 8 session for this groin pain, but it aggravated it. And so now I'm just wondering if there's other ideas. I know groin pain can take a long time to heal. It's better, like I said, but I still have pain just going up a normal height of a step or even stepping in and out of a bathtub.
So where exactly is your pain, Sharon? When you talked about your groin, does it run all the way down the inside of your leg, or is it more up by the bone? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's pretty much right into that groin crease, and more medial than lateral, but it just goes right into that.
I wonder if it's symphysis pubis.
Well, I was wondering that as well, if there was something going on with that, or somewhere along the inguinal ligament, there's so many muscles that attach there, if that could be part of it as well.
So what things in physical therapy aggravated it, Sharon?
You know, I couldn't pinpoint it. I had many different exercises she gave to strengthen. You know, I was doing some leg lifts. I was doing to the front and to the side and to the back. I was, you know, standing and then laying on my side, laying on my back. So a lot of those kind of exercises. And it just seemed like it got worse.
So do you have any sense of if it was one or two of those exercises? Like when you went to go do them, you just said to yourself, oh, I hate doing this one because it hurts? Or was it the accumulation of all of them? Do you have any sense of that?
You know, I wish I did, but I can't say because I always did them all.
Yep.
No, aren't you good? Yeah.
So, well, I'm wondering if those are just, you know, I'm thinking that's a really long lever for, was that too much, too soon, too fast, Lori? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking starting shorter lever, more core stabilization,
yep.
more starting in the core aspect, littler levers, and she's shaking her head emphatically.
Yeah,
yes.
Almost approaching it as a low back.
Exactly.
Pelvic issue rather than a primary hip issue.
Agreed.
So sometimes, you know, you have, for example, in Sharon's case, groin pain. So you really want it, you zero right in on that hip, baby. But sometimes where you have to start is around it, like starting above it, below it, and kind of funnel in towards it as you improve. So Jill's right, or I agree with Jill. I don't know if she's right, but I agree with her that jumping in with a long lever arm focused right at the hip may have been too much. And maybe you need to start around it by focusing on hip, on low back, pelvic floor, some of those things, and then funnel towards the hip itself. So you may try physical therapy again with a more spine-related approach or core related approach rather than directly at the hip.
That's what I would do.
There you go, Sharon. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. On to Bill in La Crosse. Bill, hello.
Hello, thank you. I was wondering what stenosis is and how does it make itself evident? I mean,
mm-hmm. Are you talking about spinal stenosis, Bill?
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Okay. All right, so stenosis is a narrowing. You can have stenosis of all kinds of things. You can get stenosis in your blood vessels that create things like heart attacks or whatever, but a stenosis is a narrowing. You get stenosis in your ureters, for example, in terms of your urine flow. So a stenosis is a narrowing of an opening. So in your low back, you can have stenosis generally categorized as foraminal stenosis or central canal stenosis. And I'll explain both of those. So, you know, your spinal cord runs in this big canal all the way from the base of your skull down to your tailbone. That's the central canal. And if you get stenosis there or narrowing there, you will typically get symptoms in your back as well as down both legs. It's often relieved by resting or changing position. Foraminal stenosis is, you know, your main spinal cord comes down, and then there's these little openings on both sides of your spinal column where the nerve roots come out and go out to your hips and legs and feet, and that's foraminal stenosis. So foraminal stenosis is what we see most often, and that results from usually a small disc herniation that occludes that opening, or arthritis in the facet joints, which are these little synovial joints that go all the way up and down your spine, and they're synovial joints just like your knees and stuff, such. So if you have arthritis in those, they will swell just like your knees and other big joints do, and they will occlude the opening where the nerve root comes out. In that case, you'll usually have symptoms just on one side of your body that will go down into your buttocks, down the back of your leg, or down to your foot.
And so treatment of both of those is very different, but many times patients with foraminal stenosis, the latter one that Lori discussed, if you can open up that opening, which has gotten small, typically it's through flexion is helpful, and then unloading the spine, otherwise known as getting in the pool, is also another strategy that many times helps people with foraminal stenosis. You can also get foraminal stenosis in your cervical spine as well. So it's not, that's not exclusive to the lumbar spine.
And in terms of the big picture treatment, we see both of those things. And we do, as Jill said, some strengthening and mobility, postural awareness changes and so on. In terms of if physical therapy fails, foraminal stenosis is often treated with a lumbar epidural steroid injection. Central canal stenosis cannot be treated that way. It's much harder to treat.
There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling and good luck. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Vicki in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. Yes, I fell and broke my wrist back on June 7th. And they did a reduction procedure hoping that it would stay. Well, it didn't. I ended up having surgery 2.5 weeks ago. And I'm in therapy for it. And everything's seems to be going fine. But my question is, when I wake up in the morning, will it not feel like I'm starting all over again?
Yeah.
Right. So, Vicki, did you have a Colles fracture? Do you know? Did they use that term?
No, with the radius.
Okay.
So, and then it kind of shoved, my understanding is it kind of shoved bones up on top of one another. It kind of slid
okay,
over.
Okay, like an overlapping fracture. Okay.
Yeah, I know they put in a plate and yep. 7 screws.
Yep. So that's a lot of hardware in a bone. And so how long will it take before I don't feel like somebody hit me with a sledgehammer while I'm sleeping? It's going to take some time. So your bone is now remodeling. It has plates and hardware in there. There's bone growing into that hardware as it should. The muscles, the tendons around it have all been stirred up. And so they are changing their length. They went through a traumatic experience by going through the surgery. Even though the surgery wasn't to those things, they still basically got collateral damage through this surgery. So typically when something like this happens and something is immobilized for a long period of time, as when you're sleeping and then you get up and try and move again, that's when typically we notice this pain that you're talking about. As time goes on, and I wish I could give you a number for that time, as time goes on, this will continue to subside. But patients will tell us over time that morning stiffness is much, much, much better.
It's right. Coming.
I would say I wouldn't hold my breath before 6 months.
Right. I was going to say 6 months is kind of the magic number. It's going to take some time.
Yeah.
There you go, Vicki. Good luck. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. By the way, we have open lines finally, and we'll get you involved here. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Lois in Chippewa Falls. Lois, hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, you may have answered my question already just on the last call, but I have a thumb displaced fracture on my thumb, and it was weeks before I actually had an immobilizer put on, and now it's been over 3 months, and I'm wondering, is it too late to have therapy for this, or is it never too late or what?
It's never too late, Lois, and especially when it comes to your thumb. So 70% of our hand function comes from our thumb and the opposition that we can create with that. Is this on your dominant hand?
No, but actually I'm left-handed, but I'm stronger in my right hand. Okay. Where my thumb was mobilized.
Right. So, yeah. So no, having good rehabilitation done, seeing somebody who specializes in hand therapy would be recommended. You could see a certified hand therapist. That person could be either an occupational therapist or a physical therapist. But if you call a clinic, they should be able to tell you, I have this thumb injury, I'd like to see a hand therapist, da 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 da. And to make sure that you have adequate mobility, adequate strength, adequate dexterity. Anything else you can think of, Lori?
No, that's and just making sure, I don't know how you fractured your hand, but looking again up the kinetic chain, yeah. Making sure wrist, elbow, shoulder are all in good shape, because chances are you have potentially been using this less than you normally would have. And we want to make sure that you don't end up with elbow pain or shoulder pain because of that.
Yeah. Lois, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dee in Cronenwetter, your turn. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I have a pain in my shoulder my upper arm, and it runs from like above my elbow to the back of my neck. And it's when I extend my arm, like say I'm driving and I've got my hand on the steering wheel after, you know, 20 minutes or so, it'll start to hurt. Also, when I'm sleeping, if I'm going to sleep on my other side and put my arm around my partner, anyway, I have to put my arm in a certain position or it will hurt. And I've been having the pain for years, actually. I had an accident with my elbow, needed to be pinned together, and that when I was a teenager. And I also had my ulnar nerve in the same arm. It had to be relocated because my last three fingers had been going numb. And after they moved my ulnar nerve, I mean, it restored it right away. It was amazing. But he said the ulnar nerve was as flat as a noodle. And so that operation, that was 7 years ago.
Okay. All right. So you have a lot of elbow things going on here. So, and the ulnar nerve transposition that Dee is talking about is, yes, they move the ulnar nerve from kind of where your funny bone is on your elbow. They move it in a different location because it was getting stretched or irritated. And so that's why you're getting that numbness and tingling into those digits in your hand. So that makes complete sense. Lori and I were kind of wondering, and the possibility exists that this could be coming from your cervical spine. I don't know if you've thought about, Dee, you talked about arm positions, but I wonder if there's a correlation with neck positions when your symptoms come on. Lori, have you given that any thought?
Well, yeah. And I was wondering how soon, because you said years, how soon after the ulnar nerve transposition, these other symptoms started?
No, actually, the other symptoms were there, but they were much less. And I remember mentioning them to the doctor when we were doing the ulnar nerve. And I don't know if he, you know, didn't think it was important or what. I mean, it wasn't as severe as what it is now.
Okay.
It's more or less increased over time.
Okay.
So when you talked about your arm position, it made me think of neural tension. And so then if they move the ulnar nerve there, it could be hung up somewhere more proximally. So it could be primary neck, but it could also be a neural tension issue. So your nerves glide through these sheaths all the way from your neck out to your arm. And so as you move your arm, you're getting tension on it. So whether this is primary cervical spine or neural tension from where the roots for the ulnar nerve come out of your neck, you would need to do some specific physical examination techniques to try to sort that out. And there are, if you go online and Google ulnar nerve glides, you can find these mobilization techniques where you bend your elbow and bring your hand. You can't see me, but I'm doing it. Bring your hand up by your ear.
Right. But if she had her ulnar nerve transposed, she'd have to have her elbow extended, not flexed. She should see a physical therapist. I think she's just one step too complicated.
Right.
So she could Google those ulnar nerve flossy glidey things, but I don't think they'll show them for somebody who's been transposed.
Yeah, I agree, especially if this has been years.
Yeah.
Chances are there's a lot of secondary stuff going on that needs to be unraveled in order to get you better, Dee. So I would see a physical therapist, lay out this entire history, and they will start to sort these things out one layer at a time. But it may take some time because of the duration of your symptoms and the complexity of your medical history.
Right.
Good luck, Dee. Thank you very much for calling. And Darlene in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Darlene.
Hello. I had a hip replacement almost 5 years ago. And I've had two knee replacements, and I've had the other hip done, and I had no problems. But this one, almost 5 years, I'm still limping. I have a weakness in that thigh. Now, no one said anything to me, but I really put them on the, you know, really questioned this when I went for a year checkup. And he said, you had torn muscles. So is there anything I could still possibly do for this?
So do you know what kind of approach you had? Let's talk about that first. Did you have an anterolateral approach or a posterolateral approach? Do you know? Did you have certain hip precautions after you had the surgery, Darlene?
No, not really.
Okay. All right. So because they do have to cut through certain muscles. So you feel weakness in your thigh or in the side of your hip?
I would say my thigh.
So is your incision like on the outside of your hip? Do they tell you no bending, flexing your hip past 90, no crossing your legs for the first few weeks?
You know, for the first one, they did say that, but for this one, they really didn't. But it was a whole different
team.
Physician because okay. other physicians retired.
Okay. So, the surgical procedure is different, whether it's an anterior approach or a
right.
posterior approach. So figuring out what's causing your continuing symptoms is harder when you don't know which surgical procedure the surgeon used. But I have seen patients with ongoing hip pain. I've seen patients with ongoing thigh pain following hip replacements. And the origin of that varies tremendously from one to another. So you can have tendinopathies or tendinitis or such of some of your hip muscles, particularly your gluteal muscles where they attach to the back of your hip. I've also seen just this chronic anterior and thigh pain following surgery, and that takes a long time to sort out. So some of those have ended up in, for example, pelvic floor therapy because tension in the pelvic floor is creating this hip and thigh pain. So the short answer to your question is I think you should go back to a physical therapist now that you're this far out and have them reevaluate you in the context of what kind of surgical procedure you had done. And then there are a number of possibilities of where to go from there. But yeah, that's what I would do because I don't know how much more we can add not
yeah.
knowing for sure what kind
right.
of approach you have.
Right.
Good luck. Thank you, Darlene, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, Lori Tine-Brody, our guest today as we talk physical therapy. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your aches and pains and sprains and strains today on the show, Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, one of our guests, the other, Lori Tine-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. We'll go back to the phones. Rebecca in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hello, Larry. Glad for this show. My issue is hip pain in my left hip, but I'm having a knee replacement on my right knee in this week, in a couple days. I was diagnosed with sacroiliitis a couple years ago, and it responded to therapy. My hunch is that it has kicked up again because I've been limping badly for 6 months. My concern is whether, you know, I'm going to be doing all these knee exercises on one side, and I'm worried about whether my left hip is going to hold up my right knee, whether we treat these both at once. I'm confused and a little worried.
Well, those are all valid concerns. So you have a history of some left hip pathology and know that your right lower extremity is going to be weakened temporarily by this total knee replacement on the right side. So working with your outpatient physical therapist will be really, really important because they will give you exercises specifically for your right lower extremity. The most important thing is that it doesn't jeopardize your left lower extremity. So what may happen is they may recommend, Rebecca, let's do this exercise laying down instead of standing up, because when you stand up and have to put your load through your left hip, that's bothersome. So your physical therapist should be able to modify your total joint replacement exercises to respect your left hip. And while you're there, you might as well do a two-for-one deal and get that left hip stronger. They could also make recommendations on some strengthening exercises for that left hip. So there may be modifications to your program specific to you so they can respect that weakness and that pain in your left hip.
Yeah. Also, did you get exercises previously with your sacroiliitis?
I did, and I did them faithfully for, 6 months. I haven't done them lately, I confess.
Well, you'll have some free time now that you're going to have a total knee replacement. You'll have some time to do them. So,
I would get going on those now because they apparently worked for you before. And so then, of course, the take-home message for the listeners is don't give up on those home exercise programs that are helping you maintain your current functional level. And the other take-home message from Rebecca's story is that don't limp for 6 months. You know, get a walking pole, get something so that you are not limping, because it wreaks havoc on the rest of your body. And then you end up with just this mess that you have to untangle. So limping is generally pretty bad for all kinds of body parts.
Right.
There you go, Rebecca. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Trish in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Trish.
Good morning. I have another hip question. I am just 10 days post my second anterior hip replacement, and the first one was about 5 months ago. Wondering if, from your professional's point of view, there's a faster point to get from making the decision of A to B. It took about 5 years for us to decide it's time for a hip replacement. And I did PT, I did this, that. And then they finally did an x-ray and said, you need a hip replacement. So question on, from the patient's viewpoint, how much should we be pushing?
That is such an excellent question. And I know Lori's answer will be, when your bad days outweigh your good days, it's probably time. And I will just add to that, if you are seeing a significant, I would say, compromise in your functions, in your daily activities, in your activity level, that it's starting to compromise your overall health. Well, normally I walk or bike for exercise and I can't do either of those things. And now I've put on weight. Now I'm hypertensive, things like that. Then it's definitely time. I think that that point in the sand is probably different for everybody. But I know Lori has seen a lot of patients with this and will chime in too.
Yeah. So one of the things that our surgeons say, and I appreciate very much, is that we operate on people and not on radiographs. So just because you have arthritis on a radiograph doesn't mean that you need to have a hip replacement today. It has to do with how well you are functioning with that. And you want to keep your original parts as long as you can until, as Jill said, you start to see compromise in your function. And one of the things to watch out for is I call it the frog in the pot of water. And that is, sometimes your world starts to get smaller slowly so that you don't notice it. As in, you don't go out quite as often and you're not walking quite as far as you used to, and you're sitting a little bit more. And then your world starts to get very small slowly. And so sometimes you don't notice it. So as Jill said, you want to be really cognizant of how this is affecting your function and your overall health and well-being. And that's the time to have it done.
And I love Lori's comment about we don't operate on radiographs. One of my all-time favorite stories is a PT colleague of ours from Milwaukee who at a very young age sustained a very major motorcycle accident and had major hip problems. And he puts up this radiograph for the PT students and says, look at this hip. And they all say, oh my gosh, that person must be terrible. They must walk with a walker. They must be limping. You know, oh my gosh, it's terrible. And it's actually him. And he's like running up and down the aisles and showing you. And the take-home message is, it's more based on your symptoms, not just the x-ray in and of itself.
There you go. Trish, thank you again for calling. Doc in Two Harbors, we'll go to you next. Hi, Doc.
Good morning. Say, I must say that your professionals that you have that are fielding these questions are just doing a wonderful job. I have practiced physical therapy for 40 years. I taught 20. I have my doctorate in physical therapy and so on. I'm trained by the McKinsey Institute as well. And so this is a to you, Larry, but as well to anyone who has low back pain, I would highly recommend picking up. It's a small book, probably about $10. It's called Treat Your Own Back by Robin McKenzie.
Yep.
And yeah, thank you. I've been trained by him, and it's very simple, but it really takes into account the biomechanics of we call it discogenic pain, and how sitting, there's a strong positive correlation between how long you sit and low back pain. So I just wanted to spread that out there and let people know that I highly recommend it. And one of the emphases of this book is that you need to lay on your belly flat on the floor, because that just helps to restore the normal movement within the disc. And oftentimes what you described, Larry, sounded to me like possibly very strongly that you had some discogenic pain going on. Does not mean that you herniated the disc, but you just had what we call the nucleus pulposus inside the disc, is the inside of the jelly donut, and it can shift its position. So,
yeah,
right. Yeah, that's all true, Doc. Thank you for that, and you're absolutely right. People hesitate to lie on their stomach. So the only word of caution is, if people have a true disc herniation, a serious disc herniation, lying on their stomach can be painful. So we start them in a progression, as Robin McKenzie has suggested, lying on your stomach with a small pillow underneath your stomach. We find the position that is not painful, and we're looking for that disc material to recede back into the disc. And then as it does, we want to extend back over that herniated area. So just like a cut on your skin, we want that the outside of that disc material to heal together well. And that means avoiding a lot of flexion or forward bending, but doing more extension, as Doc said. Jill?
Right. Well, and the other thing that was such a big important thing for Robin McKenzie was the repeated motions. So don't do anything just one time. Do it 5 to 10 times and see how you respond, which is exactly what Larry did and exactly what you and I talked about at the top of the show. That's a big part of the McKenzie method. And a lot of people think the McKenzie method is all extension, and it's not. So it's really treating your whole back, as Doc alluded to. And it's what happens with a lot of people who do have dyspathology is they do the extension-based portion of the program to get their symptoms, to centralize things like that, and then they never restore their function in the other direction. So there is a flexion component to it as well. And so it is really treating the whole back, as Doc alluded to. There's also one called Treat Your Own Neck that's by McKenzie as well.
Yeah. Doc, thank you so much. Very much appreciate your call. Well, and I wrote down the name of that book too.
Treat Your Own Back and Treat Your Own Neck.
Duane and Ashwabanan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was on a tree swing on July 4th, and the strap broke, and I fell flat on my butt. Since that time, it's been painful to sit. I can run, squat, climb, and crawl without any pain. However, my occupation is a cab driver, so I'm sitting, quite a bit during the day, and it seems to be constant pain. I can shift from cheek to cheek to relieve some of the pain at time, but then when I slide out of the cab and walk around in that, the pain is almost non-existent. So I was wondering if I have a bruise, maybe a bone chip, or if I'm just got to wait it out as far as the bruise is concerned.
Yeah, we're losing you there. We only have a minute or so.
Yep, I'll do my best. So there could be a couple of different things going on here. There could be some sort of bruising of the bone where Dwayne actually landed. And then the other thing that could have happened is if he landed right on his butt, he could have compressed his whole spine. So there could be pathology somewhere, you know, between the intervertebral segment, between the disc or something. And Lori's waving her hand quick.
Yeah. So it could also be some piriformis. So what I would do when I'm sitting is take two small towel rolls and put them underneath the length of your thighs, but not under your butt. And see if you still have pain. See if you take the weight directly off your butt, off those ischial tuberosities, those little bony prominences, and see if you still have pain. If you do, and if you can't resolve this, go see a physical therapist and get a good examination to find the source of your symptoms.
So there you go, Dwayne. And sounds like pretty easy way to...
That's a really quick way to kind of help with the differential diagnosis. Absolutely. For sure.
Yeah, makes good sense. Dwayne, thanks again. Appreciate your call. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Lori Tine-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news. Find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jill and Lori. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, Lori Tine-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Emails and lots of calls. Let's take a call from Russ in Stoughton next. Hi, Russ.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Hey, I am a 61-year-old tall and lanky guy that's had a sore left shoulder for the last couple of months or so. And I'm pretty active. I work out with a physical personal trainer once a week. I do a lot of hiking and walking. And my hip doesn't hurt when I you know, walk on a straight line. But if I get down on my hands and knees, and I'm sure people are familiar with kind of the cat-cow motion, I can do that just fine. But if I do that motion kind of in a circle, you know, where I'm moving more left to right, it feels like my left hip kind of gets pulled out of the socket maybe a little bit. That joint feels loose, and that's where I feel pain. So not really feeling pain like on compression from walking, but pain because the joint feels a little bit loose. And you know, when I do that kind of twisting motion.
That's interesting. So I can visualize what you're talking about, Russ, that your knee, or excuse me, your hip is flexed to 90 degrees. And then when you kind of move side to side, you're feeling this tractioning or this pulling type of thing. That isn't what I thought you were going to say. So you kind of caught me off guard with that. I suppose you could have a little bit of hip instability that just manifests when you're in that particular position. And I guess my recommendation would be if it's not bothering you with those other things, I'd probably just avoid being very aggressive in that motion. I don't know, Lori, do you have any thoughts?
Is it painful when you do that side to side, or does it just feel unstable?
Yeah, it's painful. You know, I get like a twinge.
Okay.
And then, then it'll kind of be a dull ache.
Okay, in your hip. For some reason, I thought you said shoulder at the beginning. Maybe I just heard that wrong. So
wait a minute.
In your hip.
Wait a minute.
Yep.
You started out, you said left shoulder, didn't you? And then, did I hear that right? Because that's what I wrote down. And then, then you transitioned to your hip.
My apologies if I said shoulder. I meant my left hip.
Okay, good. Okay, so we're on the right
side. I just want to make sure on the same page.
Yep.
Right. So you could have a little labral tear.
That's what I thought too. Yeah.
Yeah. So 61, active, tall, lanky, probably a little bit of wear and tear in the labrum of your hip, maybe a little bit of early osteoarthritis. And so when you make that side-to-side motion, you're just catching that spot a little bit. Do you have good mobility if you're stretching your hip, you know, in all directions?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Okay. Yeah, then I'd focus on strengthening in your hip, strengthening glutes, glute medius, et cetera, and making sure your hip flexors are nice and loose. So the only thing that bothers you is that cat and cow kind of side to side motion. Nothing else functionally bothers you?
That's when I can kind of make it hurt, so to speak.
Well, don't do
you
that.
Know, I noticed.
Yeah.
Well, don't do that. Yeah.
So but Lori has a really good point. If your motion is good and you have really good mobility there and you're not lacking motion, I wouldn't proverbially stir the pot, I guess.
Yeah.
Is kind of what I'm thinking. If it starts manifesting with other things, Russ, then we do have some concerns. But Lori's point of making sure you have really good strength around there is, I think, really important.
Good luck, Russ. Thank you very much for calling. Karen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Larry. I love your show. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask a question about like a trigger finger, they call it, but I've got a trigger thumb, okay?
Oh, yeah.
I had one on the left hand before, and they said that was an old injury. You know, it was, but now I've got it on the right hand. And I'm just, what I'm trying to do, and I just wanted to know, I'm just sorry, all the people have so many bigger problems than me, but this just, it jumps the socket, you know. I just turned 70, so I don't know, but I've got one of those things, a brace, you know, you get at the store, so I'm wearing that, and then I take that off at night, so it, you know, it doesn't rub, you know, to rest it, and then just try to massage it a little bit and see if it gets better that way.
Okay. Are you sure this is trigger thumb? Are you sure it's a tendon, or is it a significantly arthritic carpal metacarpal joint at your thumb that needs something different? I'm not convinced, Karen.
Not sure.
Okay. Okay.
I'm not sure because I'm...
Okay. That's okay.
Diagnosing myself.
That's okay. That's totally fine. And, you know, you're talking about your thumb on your dominant hand, which impacts all your activities of daily living, how you brush your teeth, your cooking, you're getting dressed, all those things. So this is a big concern. So I would see either a physical therapist or an occupational therapist that specializes in hand therapy. I hear you say you have a brace, which is great. Many times we do recommend that people wear them at night as well. So if it's an ill-fitting brace, you need to get that fixed by the OT or PT that you see. But wearing a brace at night is actually completely fine, because as you move, pull sheets up, you tug on your pillow, things like that, you could actually be irritating your thumb while you're sleeping. Lori's shaking her head.
Right, right. Yeah. And as Jill mentioned earlier in the show, your thumb is 70% of hand function. So I don't want you to minimize at all the importance of this situation that you have. So I concur with Jill. I would absolutely get this looked at. The hand therapist can talk to you about various ergonomic tools you can use around your house, whether it's scissors, cooking utensils, gardening utensils, et cetera, all kinds of things that are going to be easier on your hand. You really need good thumb function for functioning in life. So,
yeah.
So important.
And you're in Madison, so there are
lots of people. You have lots of good resources.
Lots of good people there, Karen. Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Well, let's go to Lyle and Amory. Hi, Lyle.
Good afternoon, Larry.
Good afternoon.
This is Lyle. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
About 2 years ago, I developed bone on bone and arthritis in my right knee. Then I had a stroke about 4 months ago, and my toes turned into a hammer toe affair. I had that taken care of. And now that right leg is measured at about an inch short. I was wondering if the therapist recommended having a sole put on that to correct that. It helped my hip pain with it.
Yeah.
So you have severe arthritis in that knee. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay.
It isn't hard enough to have a knee replacement.
Yeah. Okay. So I assume you've been in physical therapy following your stroke, and I assume that leg length difference is due to some of the as a result of the stroke because of your movement patterns. So if that were the case, I would have a physical therapist evaluate your gait and look at how you move to see if elevating that leg makes sense. So there are different ways to go about that. You can put a heel lift in, which is sort of a temporary measure to see if it improves your side-to-side symmetry. And then if it does, you can think about something more permanent on the bottom of your shoe. But I would not make that call myself without somebody evaluating you and your gait. Jill?
And the other thing is, typically, we don't correct for the entire discrepancy. So typically, everyone has a little bit of a leg length difference. So most people correct for about 50% of it. What'll happen is when you do this big correction is your entire nervous system gets confused. It doesn't know how to work. And so it could change a lot of things. Mm. So as Lori said, going at this gradually with a physical therapist who's seen you, been working with you, and kind of knows what your expected long-term outcomes are, is going to be a much better way to go. I think any lift that's bigger than, I believe, 3/8 of an inch, they recommend putting on the outside of the shoe. Anything less than that, I think, can go inside your shoe.
Lyle, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to George in Boyd, Wisconsin next. Hi, George.
Yeah, I just wanted to get a professional opinion on that apparatus you see on TV that you can hang upside down to stretch and release your spine and realign it. I wanted to hear from a professional. What's your opinion on that type of treatment versus somebody that just wants to sell me some equipment?
So I think you're probably talking about an inversion table where you hook your feet and then you can kind of tilt upside down. So just like everything, there are indications and contraindications for an inversion table. So there's one at my local gym, for example, and the right person should be using that. So what you have to remember about is when you hook your feet in that and hang upside down, first of all, you have to worry about blood pressure and make sure that if you're hypertensive, there are contraindications to you hanging upside down. The other thing is what it will do is the loosest joint will move first. So you're trying to get the tightest joint to move, but all the other joints will move first, and then that tight joint will move. And so it's not really specific to one joint level. Is it going to give me overall kind of a stretching elongation sensation? Yes. Could you get that other ways? Probably. So I certainly wouldn't buy one without trying it and making sure that this is something that is for you, and probably without making sure from a medical professional who knows your medical history, if this is the right thing for you from a medical perspective.
Yeah, Lori. Lots of things to consider.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at it specifically for your back, there are units that are much smaller that you sort of hook your knees around and flip over. So you don't have the option, like the inversion tables give you the option of how far you want to tip over. You can recline at 30 degrees or 45 degrees or, you know, a full upside down. These units only flip you all the way over, so hanging completely upside down, but you kind of hang from your hips and knees rather than from your ankles, so you don't get that traction through your entire leg.
George, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Kathleen emailed us. She was recently diagnosed with osteoporosis in the spine after a bone density test done in April of this year. Her T-score was minus 2.5 in lumbar spine. Currently, no back discomfort or pain whatsoever. She's seeking an endocrinologist this afternoon. What should Kathleen ask her about exercise? Also, are there physical therapists who specialize in treating osteoporosis?
Those are all fabulous questions. So a T-score of 2.5 does, by definition, meet the World Health Organization criteria for osteoporosis. And now Kathleen is going to see an endocrinologist, which is great. One of the questions I would ask the endocrinologist specifically is, am I a candidate for any medications that can be taken for this? And I'd like to do this in conjunction with physical therapy or physical activity, because we know one of the biggest risk factors with osteoporosis is falling. So taking medication will help increase your bone mineral density, but it won't do anything to prevent falls. On the other hand, seeing a physical therapist who can get your muscles stronger, get your bones stronger, and do some falls prevention is a great way to go. And I believe, Lori, in your clinic, there are people somewhere within your world that specialize in seeing patients with osteoporosis.
Right, right. At UW Health, there are physical therapists who specialize in osteoporosis. There are also those who specialize in falls, but my guess is Kathleen needs to work on the osteoporosis
right.
piece first.
Right.
So, yeah, so asking your endocrinologist who, if they are in the UW system, should know of those resources and get a referral to physical therapy specifically for initiating an exercise program in the context of someone with osteoporosis. So we typically see people here with spinal fractures, compression fractures as a result of their osteoporosis. So we really want to prevent that kind of thing. And there are specific things that you should and should not do.
Jerry emailed us, do you have tips on how to stand correctly? She stands while working at her desk station and she tries to keep good posture. Should she intentionally activate her glutes while she stands?
So that's a great question. And one of the things we know that's really hard on our body is just static anything, static sitting, static standing. So the fact that Jerry can change from sit to standing is great. Some of the things that I suggest are frequent weight shifting. So don't stand with your knees locked, but shift your weight more onto one foot than the other. Some people will put a little footstool under there and they'll rest one foot on the step stool for a while and then change. Should you keep your glutes activated, I would pull in my core muscles and make sure that my core was on. And I guess now that I'm doing it, I do probably fire my glutes a little bit as well. But don't stand there with your knees locked and not use muscles. So that's probably the number one recommendation. And Lori, is something else.
Right. So the in terms of your lumbar posture, you want to have just a little bit of tension in your lower abdominals and in your glutes. It creates this force couple that aligns your lumbar spine properly. And it's not like suck in your gut and hold yourself as tight as you can. It's the tiniest little bit of tension in both your glutes and your lower abdominals to align your lumbar spine. And if you stand with your knees locked, it will be almost impossible to do that. So you've, as Jill said, the first thing you have to do is unlock those knees, then pull up a little bit like you're gonna put on a tight pair of pants, and then keep your chin, slide your chin in a little bit, not tip it, but slide it in a little bit like the opposite of a gooseneck, so that your cervical spine is aligned and your shoulder blades are somewhat retracted back together. So your shoulders are back, which is hard if you have a computer. You really got to think about it.
Yeah. Rich in Green Bay wonders if there's any general advice to help with recovery from rotator cuff surgery. He had surgery a month ago, is still doing all the physical therapy, getting better, but still much stiffness and pain, especially at night.
Yeah, it's going to be a long haul with a rotator cuff repair. They're sewing back together muscle that we really aren't allowed to make contract for 6 weeks. So it's all somebody else moving your arm, using pulleys, things like that to make sure you have good mobility. And then at that 6 week mark, you can typically start contracting. This is going to be a long road to recovery, Rich. It's going to be a good probably 6 months or so before you feel pretty darn good. Sleeping at night is one of patients with rotator cuff pathology's chief complaint, is finding a difficult or finding a comfortable position in which they can sleep. So I tell people, if you sleep in your bed, try and elevate your head a little bit and then try and rest your arm on an elevated pillow as well. A lot of people have pain when their arm is flat by their side. Some people will fall asleep in a recliner or Barco lounger with their arm elevated a little bit, and that is A-okay as well. So you might have to try different positions. But I think one of the challenging things is when people lay down at night, they don't have something behind their arm ends up almost behind them a little bit. So bring that arm forward a little bit by putting it on a couple pillows.
Kathy in Rice Lake has recently been experiencing arthritis pain and was told there are inflammatory foods that will aggravate this. She's not aware that a food or drink might be problematic for arthritis. Any foods that might be likely culprits?
Well, it's a bit of an individual thing, but there's a fair amount of research right now going on about foods that are considered inflammatory. And this is Wisconsin Public Radio, so I hate to say this, but dairy seems to be implicated in chronic inflammation. So minimizing your dairy if you take a lot of dairy, and then increasing your foods that have the healthy fats like avocados, nuts, things like that are supposedly anti-inflammatory, as long as fruits and vegetables. If you follow what they call the DASH diet, D-A-S-H, you can Google that and find it. It's a Mediterranean type diet that is purported to have the least inflammatory effect. Realize that, like smoking, studying diet is nearly impossible for outcomes because the research is all observational. And so you have a lot of confounding factors in this kind of research. And so that's why I'm not going to hang my hat on any one thing, but that's what the research will suggest, is a DASH type diet lowers inflammation.
I was thinking about avocados because I could never get avocados. It seems like every time I wait one day too long.
Yep, or 1 minute too long. In the world of the avocado, it's like literally you wait till the next meal and it's too late.
Exactly.
I had that little experience with an avocado only yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Avocado one, Larry zero.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I bought it the day before and thought it was just going to be just right the next day.
I know. I hear you. They're feisty little buggers. My quandary is bananas. I have a whole spectrum of bananas I'll eat. It doesn't really matter what color they are, but my kids have about a 20-minute window where they think a banana is the appropriate way for them.
Same with me. Anytime I see a spotty banana, I think of you, Jill, because Jill likes her bananas spotty. If there's a spot on my banana, I am done with it.
Well, I've got a recipe up, I think, on our blog about banana chocolate chip cookies that I have made on a number of occasions when I let the bananas go too long.
Perfect.
And on that happy note, so you can check that on our blog. On that happy note, thank you both for being with us. You'll be back next month. We'll do it all over again. Thank
you. Sounds great. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, Lori Tine-Brody, our guests today, both with the University of Wisconsin. Jill is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, and Lori is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Well, tomorrow we'll get a peek behind the curtain at Door County Peninsula's Peninsula Player Theater. Looking forward to that. And then a popular historical mystery writer returns with her latest book. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.